two loose ends I want to mention before I start. One is, last time I looked at this equation. Oh, from now on I'm going to, I will succumb to my, my habit and call the conductivity gamma instead of sigma. So this is a linear equation. And we said we solve this Dirichlet problem and we define the Dirichlet to Neumann map to be the normal component of gamma grad u. And so what I mentioned is that this map is nonlinear. And this is the map we're going to spend a lot of time trying to understand. And so I was saying we're doing nonlinear problems on linear equations. What I want to mention is that there's also a mini industry which does nonlinear problems. Nonlinear. So inverse problems for nonlinear PDEs. So some examples if you take a semilinear Schrödinger operator for a large class of A, you can solve this Dirichlet problem. And so to not confuse the notation, I say lambda sub A to be this. You define this to be du d nu on the boundary. So for a large class, AXS for which star is uniquely solvable, in fact the largest class for which I could prove that the forward problem is solvable, this is in joint work with Isakov in 2D, and there's Isakov, Sylvester in dimensions 3 or higher. Basically, we recover AXS from lambda A. There are subtleties, but I won't mention them right now. Okay, so people also look at more nonlinear things, things like this. Where again, the dependence in the gradient is nonlinear, and the idea is to recover these functions. So it turns out, if you understand the linear problems, that can serve as a basis for understanding the nonlinear ones. So I won't spend much time on this. unless there is very strong enthusiasm in that direction from the audience. So that's one loose end I wanted to mention. The other one is I showed you some pictures in ultrasound where you make measurements of the solution of the wave equation. And you want to recover C of X. And I showed you some results which looked very good. I don't want to mislead you. Although we do have uniqueness results for this problem, in some sense the problem is still open. So the problem of finding a good, efficient, numerical algorithm for reconstructing, for instance, the speed of sound from knowledge of the waves on the boundary is still an open problem. Okay, so those are just two the two loose ends I had to get off my chest. Now that Sarah's here, we can start in earnest. What I want to talk about, at least in the first hour or so, is what Calderon did. Not exactly the way he did it, but essentially the way he did it. And the reason is that that inspired what came after, and it'll give us a chance to get some preliminaries out of the way. So some preliminaries. First, let me remind you about integration by parts. So this is just motivation, so I'm not going to state the assumptions very carefully. I'm just going to say if gamma and omega are sufficiently smooth, and you don't need much smoothness at all, well, over here, in case you forgot, I'm going to write the divergence theorem, which says that if F is a vector field, and divergence F is the sum dfj dxj, then the integral of divergence F over omega is equal to f dot nu d sigma, and here nu is the outer unit normal, and sigma d sigma is surface measure. So, for instance, if omega is given locally as the graph of a function let's say xn equals phi of x prime. I picked the wrong locally over here. Right? Then you learned from calculus that a normal is given by this vector. We normalize it. This is an outer normal. We normalize it to be by dividing by that. So this is our nu at the point phi x prime, x prime phi x prime. And the surface measure d sigma is the square root of 1 plus grad phi x prime squared dx prime. And the reason I'm writing these down is to show you they make sense when phi is a Lipschitz function. So we say omega Lipschitz if locally the graph of phi, where phi is a Lipschitz function, meaning that phi of x prime minus phi of y prime is less than a constant x prime minus y prime. And such functions are differentiable almost everywhere with a bounded derivative bounded by C. So this makes sense and is bounded almost everywhere, and so does all of that. Okay, so that's the divergence theorem. Suppose, let's say here, let's insert U, and suppose U satisfies the basic elliptic PDE we're talking about. And V is some smooth function arbitrary smooth function in omega. So apply the divergence theorem to the vector field F is V gamma grad U. Gamma can be a matrix. This is then a vector, and so this is a vector field. And so we have divergence F which is by the divergence theorem F dot nu d sigma. That's V times nu dot gamma grad U. So this is equal to V times the Dirichlet to Neumann map applied to F. Right? If you look up there, the normal component of what last time we called the current is by definition the Dirichlet to Neumann map applied to F. Meanwhile, on the other side, the divergence of F is grad V dot gamma grad U plus V divergence gamma grad U. Product rule. And divergence gamma grad U is zero. So the upshot is that V lambda gamma F d sigma equals grad V dot gamma grad U. So we're going to use this to define the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the case where things are not smooth. But I want to make a remark here to tie in with things you may have seen in your basic PDE course. See, with the basic Dirichlet, so remark, the Dirichlet principle we learn, for instance, that the minimum over all functions in H1 which are equal to f, a given function f on the boundary of the Dirichlet integral This is attained for U satisfying the elliptic PDE. Okay, that's a basic thing we learn. In fact, one often proves the uniqueness, existence of uniqueness for the Dirichlet problem this way these days. Well, so if you plug that in there, the remark I want to make is, okay, that's the function which minimizes the Dirichlet integral, but what's the value of the minimum? What's the minimum value? Well, the minimum value, if you plug that in there, you get F lambda gamma F. So if you give me a function on the boundary and you ask me what's the minimum of the corresponding Dirichlet integral, if I know the Dirichlet to Neumann map, I can just tell you the answer. Okay, so now we're going to use these things to do things more rigorously for the weak solutions. So, coming back to the integration by parts, or here, So now apply star to V smooth, but of compact support in omega. Well, then the boundary integral disappears because V is zero on the boundary. And we get that the integral of grad V gamma grad U is zero. If U satisfies that. So we define a weak solution U of this equation to be an H1 function satisfying this for all V C infinity of compact support. Okay, so that's the standard definition of a weak solution. So if we have a pointwise solution in the classical sense that this is true, the advantage here is that only one derivative of U appears. And by the way, since this so if V and U are in H1, gradient U is in L2, a bounded function times an L2 function is an L2 function. This is an L2 function, and so a trivial estimate says that and so this is true. You can now complete, take the completion of C0 infinity in the H1 norm, hence for all V in H1 0 omega. So this is the completion in the H1 norm. So these are the functions with one derivative in L2, obtain the limits of function of compact support. And this, by the way, is the same as V in H1, where the trace of V on the boundary is zero. So it's not a fancy abstract space, it's simply the functions which vanish on the boundary. And that's all you need for that term to disappear. Okay, so with these preliminaries out of the way, let me restate the basic theorem for the forward problem. Perhaps a little bit differently than I stated it last time. So suppose gamma is a positive definite matrix with gamma ij C Cxcj. And the boundary of omega is Lipschitz. Omega is a bounded Lipschitz domain in Rn. So we think of gamma as bounded away from zero and basically bounded. So this is almost everywhere. Those are the assumptions. For any f h a half on the boundary, so these are traces of H1 functions, and big F H minus 1 omega, this is the dual of H1 0, there is a unique U in H1 such that let's say a weak solution of gamma grad U equals F with trace of u equals little f on the boundary. So this is in omega. Furthermore, the H1 norm of u is bounded by a constant times the h a half norm of little f plus the h minus 1 norm of big F. So there's some instances where we want to have the non-homogeneous problem with a big F on that side, and this is a soft theorem. Okay? It takes, if you don't know anything about Sobolev spaces and so forth, it takes quite a while to prove it. But it's done by basically functional analytic method, the Lax-Milgram lemma. Nothing hard here. And so, motivated by star, we now define lambda gamma, an operator from H a half to H minus a half, so bounded operator. So let's see. I start with little f in H a half. I claim I'm getting something in H minus a half. h minus a half is the dual of h a half. So to tell you what this is, I have to pair it with a g. Let's agree that when I put pointy brackets, I mean the bilinear pairing. And for round brackets, so this is bilinear pairing. And for round brackets, I will use, so this is the conjugate linear. In the first variable. So in other words, when I integrate against G bar, I will use Brown bracket when I just, it's linear in G and this, I call it. Okay. So informally, that would be G lambda gamma F. So I simply define it to be equal to grad V gamma grad U where V is any H1 function with V on the boundary equals G, and U is the weak solution of the Dirichlet problem. Gamma grad U equals 0, U on the boundary equals F. So the first thing to note it is well defined. So if V tilde is some other thing in H1, also has V tilde restricted to the boundary equal G, then lambda gamma then V minus V tilde, this is zero because V minus V tilde on the boundary is zero, and U is a weak solution. Right? We saw that this was true whenever this is an H1 function with zero trace on the boundary. So this integral, in some sense, only depends on, well, in fact, it does, only depends on what V does on the boundary. Gamma is L infinity. The L infinity norm is bounded by C1. And second of all, lambda gamma F paired with G let's choose V, say, the weak solution of a harmonic function equal to G on the boundary, so that the H1 norm is less than a constant times the H a half norm of G. Or you can use a more abstract extension theorem. Anything, any little g in H a half of the boundary has an extension V to H1 inside. Right? You give me little g, there's a V inside, such that the H1 norm is less than that. So this is less than a constant times gamma L infinity times the H1 norm of V, H1 norm of U, G H a half, F H a half. So for any G, this gadget paired with G, for any G in H a half, this gadget paired with G gives you something bounded. Hence, lambda gamma F is less than a constant times F H a half. And by that I mean the H minus a half norm. Right? How do we test the H minus a half norm? We pair it with an H a half and see if it's a bounded functional on H a half. So this shows that lambda gamma F makes sense as an element in H minus a half. It also shows that lambda gamma is a bounded operator from H a half to H minus a half. So given this theorem, we have now a nice clean definition of the Dirichlet to Neumann map. So what Calderon did is to look at the linearized version of this map. So what do I mean by that? I.e., we want to compute the derivative of lambda gamma with respect to gamma at gamma naught in the direction gamma. That looks like more than a mouthful, but actually it's very intuitive. you start at a conductivity gamma naught, which is essentially where you are taking the derivative. You take gamma naught plus a little bit times gamma, so gamma is the direction in which you're taking the derivative. And take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. Okay? So again, you can think of that as the directional derivative of this in the direction gamma at the conductivity gamma naught. Of course, we're taking derivative in infinite dimensional space here. So for that, we need to look at the difference between two gamma. So let's first find the formula for the difference of two Dirichlet to Neumann maps with gamma 1, gamma 2 conductivities. I guess I didn't have a double star yet. Satisfying double star. We start by noting that lambda gamma is a symmetric operator. In other words, i.e., lambda gamma F paired with G is the same as F paired with lambda gamma G. Now, this we defined by grad V gamma grad U. Where U is a weak solution to this, and V is arbitrary. So choose V, satisfying that. I can choose any H1 V. Let's choose the solution to this Dirichlet problem. Of course, arbitrary with equal to little g on the boundary. So then this is by the same definition. How are we defining that? Well, we take the weak solution V of that Dirichlet problem, put it here, and hit that against any U in H1, in particular this U in H1. And now this equals that, because gamma is the, should have said symmetric positive. Well, when I say positive definite, I mean symmetric. Okay, so you can flip the Dirichlet to Neumann map from one of these to the other. So now, lambda gamma 1 F in a product G is equal to gamma 1 grad U. Solution to this Dirichlet problem. And G gamma 2 F is equal to F gamma 2 G. As long as I choose V, the solution to this Dirichlet problem. So I can subtract these two identities. Get this three-star identity, which, as you saw, was totally trivial. Some people call this Alessandrini's identity. Other people are offended to put a name on integration by parts. We could call it our three-star identity so as not to offend anybody. In the next hour, this will allow us to calculate the Fréchet derivative. But more importantly, this will be the starting point for much of what we will do, because you see it gives you essentially the only handle we have to relate information we are given on the boundary to the objects inside which we're trying to reconstruct. So this has happening on the boundary. This has to do with the inside. Okay, it's break time. So now we want to move on to the injectivity of the map gamma to lambda gamma. So we're no longer taking the derivative. We want the nonlinear map. The Sylvester Woman idea. So at the time, this was not as wonderfully transparent as I'm going to show it to you as it is now understood. The idea is the following. So given two conductivities, which give you the same measurements, we want to show gamma 1 is gamma 2. This implies, via triple star, that that's zero for every F and G. So it implies that grad V dot gamma 1 minus gamma 2 grad U equals zero for all U and V satisfying right, it's true for every F and G. So if you give me a solution U that satisfies this equation, I just take F to be its trace on the boundary, G to be the trace of V. I know this is zero, therefore this will be zero. Well, so far, yes.
The only data we have is near constant.
No, we're done with that. So we have proved that for the linearized operator near constant functions, the linearized operator is injective on isotropic matrices. End of story.
Not
no. Only the ideas and the motivation are building blocks. No, not a building block. We just look at this. So this is it. You can reformulate basically, you can reformulate the inverse problem in terms of density of products of gradients of solutions. Okay. So what's different now is that these are U satisfies the equation for gamma 1, V satisfies the equation for a different conductivity, whereas there they were both the same gamma naught. That's not really the major thing. The major thing is that this depends on the conductivities which we're playing with. So this U depends on gamma 1, V depends on gamma 2. This is a nonlinear expression in gamma 1, gamma 2. And furthermore, these PDEs have variable coefficients. So we can't just write down solutions for them. Okay, clear? So the Sylvester Ulmai idea is this. Fix Xi in Rn, just as we did in the Calderon argument. Note that we can choose zeta in Cn with zeta squared equals 0, zeta plus xi squared equals 0, and length of zeta arbitrarily large. Is that true? Not in two dimensions. That is why, so this is only works provided n bigger than or equal to 3. That's the place where their proof breaks down in 2D. But if we're in three dimensions and higher, it's perfectly fine. You take a zeta of length a million, a zeta I of length a million, and then a zeta R of length a million pointing out of the blackboard. You know, you can write them down if you like, but I don't want to bore you with that sort of little calculation time. Okay? So if we could construct solutions u x zeta of this equals 0. Such that u x zeta behaves like e to the I x zeta for zeta large. Any gamma. You give me a conductivity. This is a forward problem. You give me a conductivity. Is it possible to have solutions of this linear PDE given a parameter zeta which approximate the solutions of the Laplacian when zeta becomes large? So this is motivated a little bit by scattering theory, where for large energies, you don't see the x dependent in a potential. Well, if we could do this, right, we could substitute in there, let zeta go to infinity, and we'd be back in this kind of situation calculation without having linearized the operator. So the idea is to, rather than linearize the operator, to use the freedom of this large zeta to play our game. Well, this is for gamma anisotropic. No one can do this. In fact, I believe you can show this is false. For gamma isotropic, so again, I remind you, what does isotropic mean? It just means it's a diagonal matrix. It's gamma x, 0. So it's gamma times the identity matrix. It's a scalar valued function. We can almost do this. So this is false, but what you can do ux zeta 1 over gamma to the 1 half e to the ix zeta for zeta goes to infinity. As we will see. So this suggests the change of dependent variable u of x equals 1 over, so from now on, gamma is isotropic, bounded away from 0. It turns out this is a well-known change. So let's quickly see what happens. Grad u will be minus a half grad gamma over gamma to the 3 halves w plus 1 over gamma to the 1 half grad w. So gamma grad u is minus a half grad gamma to the 1 half plus gamma to the 1 half grad w. So divergence of gamma grad u equals minus a half divergence of gamma over gamma to the 1 half w minus 1 half grad gamma dot grad w over gamma to the 1 half plus 1 half grad gamma, grad w, over gamma to the 1 half, plus gamma to the 1 half, plus w. So if you didn't know that this was the correct power, and you just wrote u of x is gamma to the alpha W. You would look for the precise alpha, which would get you rid of the first order terms in W. So this is equal to 0. And we're left with minus Laplace W plus QW equals 0, where Q equals 1/2 divergence grad gamma over gamma to the 1/2. Divided by gamma to the 1/2. And you can check this is the Laplacian of gamma to the 1/2 over gamma to the 1/2. Very good question. So this turned out to be a very useful thing to do to move the problem forward. Otherwise, Calderon's problem would still be open today. But for where we are nowadays, it's a very bad thing to do. For the reason Sarah points out, is that from now on, this change of variable requires gamma to have two derivatives in some LP space, appropriate P. Well, so what I mentioned last time is state of the art. If you now bring in the sharpest estimates you can muster is for this kind of thing to work, is it has been pushed to gamma in C 3/2. So I'm going to continue with the story of what happens here. But I want to point out that you can bring this down a bit, as we'll see in 2D, to things with one derivative. The problem is that the rougher gamma is, the less this is a good approximation. So it's not just the matter that we're incapable of proving the right estimates. It's that the ansatz becomes wrong, I believe, for non-smooth gamma. So I believe this is completely wrong, for instance, when gamma is in an L infinity. And so the large zeta dependence will pick up discontinuities of gamma and so forth. So the rougher gamma is, the more complicated the large zeta dependence. Okay. But let's not miss the point that at least when things are nice, it's possible to take this divergence form operator and change it to a Schrödinger operator. Now I'm looking at this potential and I don't quite see. Well, maybe I shouldn't get. I know that's the correct formula. By the way, a little exercise for the interested reader. So this is, it looks like a lot of work, but my energy in assigning things will fall off exponentially. A good exercise is, well, I did this for classical solutions. So work this out for weak solutions, since we talked about that. Well, that's what I messed up somewhere, because there shouldn't be another term. Let's see. I'm not ready to claim mistake yet. Let's see. Gamma. Divergence of that. Minus a half that plus that plus that. Okay. So all right, let's do it. What is the divergence of it's 1/2 gamma to the 1/2 Laplace gamma over gamma to the 1/2. Okay, minus gradient of this. Gradient of this is minus 1/4 gamma to the 3/2, so that's 2 grad gamma squared. Okay, on the other hand, what is the Laplacian of gamma to the 1/2? Laplace of gamma to the 1/2 is divergence of gradient gamma to the 1/2, which is 1/2 gamma to the minus 1/2 grad gamma. Oh, there we go. Yeah, so never mind this step. Divergence of gamma, grad gamma over gamma to the 1/2 with a 1/2 is just the Laplacian of gamma to the 1/2. This is remark. So let's define lambda q. So this is abuse of notation, but there's no risk of confusion. Wherever we say Q, we mean the Schrödinger operator. So given Q, you solve this problem in omega. So you solve this Dirichlet problem. And define lambda QF to be the normal derivative of the solution to the Dirichlet problem. So this brings a related inverse problem. Does lambda Q determine Q? So I give you a little potential. You solve this Dirichlet problem, gives you a new Dirichlet to Neumann map. Does it determine the potential? I should make the note that while for conductivities, the Dirichlet problem is always uniquely solvable, that's not true for potentials. So this is assuming zero is not a Dirichlet eigenvalue. Minus Laplace plus Q. Of course, when Q is like that, we know by going back to gamma that zero will not be a Dirichlet eigenvalue. But if I give you a general potential Q in omega, it's quite possible, right? I mean, you know, even for Q equals zero, we have, Right, we know there are eigenmodes for the Laplacian. So if I take Q equal this particular eigenvalue, right, I would have a non-uniqueness for the Dirichlet problem. So assume that's not the case, then we can define this. Does this determine Q? Here's a little open problem. So preview, sneak preview. Yes, if n is bigger than or equal to 3. Yes, so what I showed in n equals 2 dimensions I showed the answer is yes, provided Q comes from a conductivity. Which was precisely, of course, what you need for the Calderon problem. So with yes, if Q comes from a conductivity when n is 2, open problem for general Q. If you want to know how regular, well, C infinity, if you like, but bound at Q. So that's a lovely open problem. A number of people have tried and failed to prove this. In fact, the Isozaki business on hyperbolic manifolds, which I'd like to get to later in the semester, was initially claimed as a proof for general Q in n equals 2, so using hyperbolic manifolds. It turns out there was a mistake, and this is still open. Eskin from UCLA also sent out a preprint about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, claiming to have proved this and then withdrew it a year later. All right. So, right. So what this is, I will explain, of course, where that comes from. Basically, what it means, you look at the Schrödinger operator, and you look at its Dirichlet eigenvalues. Then that's roughly equivalent to, so the Q comes from, or maybe precisely equivalent, comes from a conductivity if and only if, so the eigenvalues are lambda 1, if and only if lambda 1 is positive. I.e. the Schrödinger operator is positive in omega, in the sense of operators. Okay. So, can you erase this since you caught the point? So what does this inverse problem have to do with the previous one? If you can solve this, can you solve the other one? So here is gamma grad nu, grad u. So lambda gamma f equals nu dot gamma grad u on the boundary, which is minus a half w on the boundary, plus gamma to the 1/2. Oops, this should be a nu. Gamma to the 1/2 dw d nu. So exercise part 1 And part two, here, right. Part two, show that lambda gamma is minus 1 over 2 d gamma d nu. So lambda gamma g So W on the boundary, let's continue. W on the boundary is gamma to the 1/2 F, right? Because W is gamma to the 1/2 U. And U is F on the boundary. So plus gamma to the 1/2 I'll write it dw d nu for now. So the exercise is show that the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the conductivity equals minus 1/2 d gamma d nu plus gamma to the 1/2. Well, this is the Dirichlet to Neumann map for Q applied to what W is on the boundary, which is gamma to the 1/2 F. So what I mean by show is do this for the weak definition of lambda gamma that we had. So lambda Q FG would have to be something like that. And it's a bit of work to it's nothing deep, but it's helps you be more familiar with these things. And so one of the items that I mentioned last time that one can discuss is a separate proof that lambda gamma determines gamma on the boundary and d gamma d nu on the boundary. So if you make these voltage and current measurements on the boundary, right, we should hope we should be able to get the conductivity on the boundary. At first it sounds obvious, I'll just put my electrodes and measure, but the moment you put electrodes, stuff goes inside. So the idea is to use the skin effect. You put highly oscillatory solutions on the boundary, which will tend to stay on the boundary, and therefore give you the conductivity and its normal derivative on the boundary. So this is not trivial, but not hard. And hence, given the lambda gamma, which is what we're given ourselves, we can determine, calculate Q. Sorry, lambda Q. Because of this formula. And so now we are in the, at least apparently, simpler situation where we give ourselves the Dirichlet to Neumann map for a Schrödinger operator, and we want to find the potential. Yes. Forget that. Yes, finished. Right. We have not answered that yet. Right. We have started it. Yes, go ahead. Right. So the idea is that now, because for the Schrödinger problem, it is true that you can find solutions that behave like that. Correct. Okay, so well, no, this is what people mean when they say this is injectivity. So if two Qs have the same lambda, do they have to be the same? Actually, I do want more than that. I would also like to be able to calculate Q from lambda Q. Okay, so let me maybe to help the train of thought. Mention what we'll talk about next time. Given Q, we'll construct solutions. Let's call them phi or psi. Psi x zeta, q and zeta in Cn with zeta squared equals 0, will construct solutions of minus Laplacian plus q psi equals 0 with psi behaving like e to the I x zeta for zeta large. We'll use them in an identity like this to show injectivity. And then in 2D, that's not enough. In 2D, we'll start complex analysis. On the variety zeta squared equals 0. Now, at some point, I will want to show that shouldn't go under next time because I can't promise I'll do it next time. But I want to show the connection between this Dirichlet-Neumann map and the scattering operator for the Schrödinger operator. I should also mention that these solutions they look like plane waves if you just look at this, but then their amplitude is exponentially growing in some directions, decaying in some other directions. These solutions go back to, in fact, to Hermann Weyl, and people in quantum optics call them non-homogeneous plane waves. In other words, the amplitude depends on where you are. And so somehow, if you look back in Hermann Weyl, the idea of playing with complex analysis in the zeta parameter goes back to him. And I think that's part of the fun in this problem. Where? Very good question. In fact, nobody can do it by prescribing a boundary condition. And so instead, we'll be doing it in all of space. The trick being that once you are here, the boundary condition disappears. If I know this is zero, then this has to be zero for any solutions V and U. I don't need to know their boundary. But that's a good point. That was part of what made the Sylvester Ullmann work. Okay, so see you in a week. Hope you remember it all by then.
Here's